to disavow the charge that he had bought back government debt at inflated rates to help speculators. Mercer partially retracted his words and admitted that Hamilton had never bought government bonds for personal gain. On the other hand, he insisted that Hamilton had exerted his influence to attach to your administration a moneyed interest as an engine of government. Unable to let the matter drop, Hamilton knocked on Mercer's door in Philadelphia that December and demanded a further retraction. Hamilton got enough satisfaction. "I spoke nothing that could tend, in my opinion, to wound your honesty or integrity," Mercer conceded, that a possible duel was averted. Hamilton may have opposed duels on principle, as he later claimed, but for such a hot-headed man, these affairs of honor were expedient weapons in silencing his enemies. Whenever he was maligned, Hamilton aggressively sought retractions, persisting to the bitter end. On December 5, 1792, members of the Electoral College assembled in their respective states. The outcome gratified Hamilton and corresponded with his expectations. Washington was chosen unanimously as president. Adams received 77 votes, enough to return him as vice president, while George Clinton gained a respectable 50 votes. In his honors, always to be taken with a pound of salt, Jefferson reported that Senator John Langdon had commented to Adams on the closeness of his vote. According to Langdon, Adams gritted his teeth and exclaimed, "Damn 'em, damn 'em, damn 'em. You see that an elective government will not do." On the surface, the election seemed an impressive show of national unity when it was just a passing truce in an ongoing war. For the last time, George Washington's prestige papered over growing differences between Hamiltonians and Jeffersonians. 3 days after the Electoral College met, James Monroe resumed his newspaper defense of Jefferson and slammed Hamilton as someone suspected with too much reason to be attached to monarchy. Far more noteworthy than such hackneyed tirades against Hamilton, however, were the first shots fired at Washington. No longer a sacred figure, immune to criticism, he was spattered with mud by Philip Freneau, who accused him of aping royalty in his presidential etiquette. A certain monarchical prettiness must be highly extolled, such as levees, drawing rooms, stately nods instead of shaking hands, titles of office, seclusion from the people. Given Washington's reluctance to serve a second term, this was an especially undeserved cut, and Adams lamented the sour, angry, peevish, fretful, lying paragraphs with which the press battered the government. Clearly, the political tone in Washington's second term was going to be even harsher than in the first. Right before Christmas, Hamilton wrote a despairing letter to John Jay. He was worn down by the interminable attacks against him and slander he felt powerless to stop. He told Jay that he was oppressed by the weight of official business and the need to track legislative maneuvers against him, but that his burden and perplexity had still more sinister origins. "'Tis the malicious intrigues to stab me in the dark, against which I am too often obliged to guard myself, that distract and harass me to a point which, rendering my situation scarcely tolerable, interferes with objects to which friendship and inclination would prompt me." Hamilton wrote this cheerless assessment 3 days after meeting with Muhlenberg, Venable, and Monroe. He must have known the Mariah Reynolds affair would have repercussions for many years to come. As Washington's first term ended in early 1793, the president remained distraught over his bickering cabinet. He continued to admonish his headstrong secretaries of Treasury and State that they should try to get along for the national good. Jefferson assured the president that he would strive for unity and that he had kept myself aloof from all cabal and correspondence on the subject of the government. In the next breath, however, he renewed his corrosive attacks on Hamilton. Washington's vaunted patience was giving way to petulant flashes of temper, and, according to Jefferson, he expressed the extreme wretchedness of his existence while in office and went lengthily into the late attacks on him for levies. This was an implicit rebuke of Jefferson, for it was Freneau who had accused Washington of holding royal levies or receptions. Even as Jefferson mouthed sedative pledges of peace, he and Madison were secretly orchestrating the first concerted effort in American history to expel a cabinet member for official misconduct. They had come to regard Hamilton as a grave threat to Republican government, a monarchist bent on destroying the Republic, all without any proof. The National Gazette put it that Hamilton fancies himself the great pivot upon which the whole machine of government turns, throwing out of view the president, the legislature, and the Constitution itself. Jefferson and Madison abandoned any residual restraint as they prepared to launch an all-out inquisition. To disguise their efforts, they employed as their surrogate a fiery Virginia congressman, William Branch Giles, who later courted one of Jefferson's daughters. As early as the spring of 1792, Hamilton had suspected intrigue within the Virginia delegation and identified Madison as the prompter of Mr. Giles and others who were the open instruments of opposition. The husky, often unkempt Giles was a Princeton graduate and noted Virginia lawyer. He shared his state's endemic hatred of banks and modern finance and thought a northern faction was out to destroy the Union. As a frequent mouthpiece for Jefferson, he employed his pugnacious style for states' rights and did not spare anyone in the Federalist opposition. He even accused Washington of showing a princely ignorance of the country, evidenced by the fact that the wants and wishes of one part had been sacrificed to the interest of the other. Giles tried to discredit Hamilton over his use of money that the government had borrowed in Europe. This charge originated in a memo that Jefferson had prepared surreptitiously for Madison. Hamilton had wanted to use foreign loans to repay a government loan from the Bank of the United States, $2 million that the bank had extended to the federal government to purchase stock in the bank itself. Partial as ever to the French Revolution, the Jeffersonians feared that this money would be diverted from American debt payments to France. In the past, Hamilton had applied foreign loans to the repayment of domestic debt, a technical violation of the law but one, he claimed, that had been approved verbally by Washington. The suspicion prevailed among critics, however, that he wanted to transfer borrowed funds from Europe to the National Bank to aid speculators. And a small circle of opponents, including Jefferson and Madison, now also knew about the denouement of the Mariah Reynolds affair, with its accusations of official wrongdoing by Hamilton. Twice in late December 1792, the House demanded from Hamilton a strict accounting of foreign loans. Distracted by the Reynolds probe, he still managed to crank out a detailed report by January 3rd. The beleaguered Hamilton felt the weight of unseen forces marshaled against him and feared he was now the target of a highly organized attempt to destroy his reputation. Planning to exhaust Hamilton, Giles submitted 5 resolutions in the House on January 23rd, calling for still more extensive information on foreign loans. By design, these resolutions made massive, nay, overwhelming demands on Hamilton. He had to furnish a complete reckoning of balances between the government and the central bank, as well as a comprehensive list of sinking fund purchases of government debt. Some historians, including Giles's biographer, believe that Jefferson instigated these resolutions, with Madison drafting their language. Taking advantage of a short, 4-month congressional session, the House gave Hamilton an impossible March 3rd deadline. Republicans hoped that Hamilton's failure to comply would then be construed as prima facie evidence of his guilt. Federalists were equally convinced that he would prove to be incorruptible. Hamilton's critics seriously underrated his superhuman stamina. He enjoyed beating his enemies at their own game, and the resolutions roused his fighting spirit. By February 19th, in a staggering display of diligence, he delivered to the House several copious reports, garlanded with tables, lists, and statistics that gave a comprehensive overview of his work as Treasury Secretary. In the finale of one 20,000-word report, Hamilton intimated that he had risked a physical breakdown to complete this heroic labor. "It is certain that I have made every exertion in my power, at the hazard of my health, to comply with the requisitions of the House as early as possible." Hamilton's reports did not sway his opponents, who wanted to expose him, not engage him in debate. Every proof of his prodigious gifts made him seem only the more threatening. Defying Washington's appeal for a truce with Hamilton, Jefferson intensified the combat at close quarters. On February 25th, he proposed to Washington an official inquiry into Hamilton and the Treasury Department, a demand Washington spurned bluntly. Hamilton thought Jefferson should leave the cabinet and openly head the opposition, rather than subvert the administration from within. In response, Thomas Jefferson did something extraordinary. he drew up a series of resolutions censuring Hamilton and quietly slipped them to William Branch Giles. Jefferson now functioned as de facto leader of the Republican Party. The great irony was that the man who repeatedly accused Hamilton of meddling with Congress and violating the separation of powers was now secretly scrawling congressional resolutions directed against a member of his own administration. When Giles filed 9 censure resolutions against Hamilton in late February, he did not disclose that they were based on Jefferson's rough draft. The telltale document did not even surface until 1895. Giles introduced his charges with what one spectator described as a most pointed attack on Hamilton. The resolutions accused Hamilton of indecorum in dealing with Congress and of improperly mixing foreign and domestic loans. Giles omitted 2 of the more outlandish resolutions drawn up by Jefferson, a claim that Hamilton had attempted to benefit speculators and a demand that the treasurer's office be hived off from the rest of the Treasury Department. 1 Jefferson resolution exposed the true intent behind his vendetta. "Resolved that the Secretary of the Treasury has been guilty of maladministration in the duties of his office and should, in the opinion of Congress, be removed from his office by the President of the United States." By submitting these resolutions on the eve of the congressional recess, Giles intended to deprive Hamilton of adequate time to rebut the charges. Despite Madison's support, the House roundly voted down these resolutions. Jefferson anticipated this defeat, but knew that the unsubstantiated accusations would float tantalizingly in the air. As he observed, the resolutions would enable people to see from this the extent of their danger. The upshot of the abortive Republican campaign was an almost total vindication of Hamilton. All 9 of the Virginians' resolutions were defeated on March 1st. At worst, Hamilton was found guilty of excessive discretion in shifting money among accounts to ensure that the government did not miss interest payments. He also was not always meticulous in matching specific loans to the laws authorizing them, but nobody ever proved that Alexander Hamilton had diverted a penny of public money for personal profit. Federalists rejoiced that the Republican vendetta had backfired, and one Boston Federalist exclaimed, "The conquest to the cause of government and the reputation of Hamilton must be as glorious as it was unexpected." Hamilton, however, foresaw further attacks. "There is no doubt in my mind," he told Rufus King, "that the next session will revive the attack with more system and earnestness." By this point, harassment was exacting a terrible physical and mental toll on the exhausted Hamilton. Sometimes he vented his rage in essays that he let molder in his drawer. In one unpublished essay, he railed against the Jeffersonians as wily hypocrites and crafty and abandoned impostors. He now viewed hypocrisy and treachery as the most successful commodities in the political market. "It seems to be the destined lot of nations to mistake their foes for their friends, their flatterers for their faithful servants." He believed that he had made a huge but thankless sacrifice for his country. Hamilton was correct that Jefferson and his cohorts had no intention of desisting in their attacks. He now discovered that Muhlenberg, Venable, or Monroe, or perhaps all 3, had breached the vow of confidentiality in the Reynolds affair. In early May 1793, Hamilton's old friend from Revolutionary days, Henry Lee, wrote from Virginia, "Was I with you, I would talk an hour with doors bolted and windows shut, as my heart is much afflicted by some whispers which I have heard." The vindication of Hamilton by Congress only strengthened the faith of the Jeffersonians that legislators could never exercise independent judgment when it came to him. Jefferson now asked John Beckley to provide him with a list of papermen, that is, congressmen who held bank stock or government bonds. The supposed conflicts of interest of these legislators gave Jefferson the all-purpose explanation he needed to explain Hamilton's acquittal. Madison, too, ascribed the defeated resolutions to corrupt congressmen who had profited from Hamilton's fiscal measures. At this stage, it grew more and more evident to Jefferson that he would have to perpetuate the struggle against the Treasury Secretary, not from inside the government, but from the safe haven of Monticello. In the wake of their setback, Republicans seeking more damaging information about Hamilton latched on to a disgruntled former Treasury Department clerk named Andrew Francis. At first glance, he seemed like a magnificent find, an angry man with inside knowledge of Hamilton's official duties. He had labored at the Treasury Department from its formation in 1789 until he was fired in March 1793. After moving to New York City, Francis was short of money and longed to retaliate against Hamilton. In May 1793, he presented to the Treasury two warrants for redemption that dated back to the early Confederation period. In the first days of the new government, Treasury officials had routinely honored these claims, but they later declined automatic payment as they discovered how slipshod had been the paperwork of their predecessors. As a one-time Treasury employee, Francis knew this history. Nonetheless, when his claims were denied, he protested that he was being penalized by the Treasury Secretary, and he pestered both Hamilton and Washington for payment. In early June, Francis not only returned to Philadelphia, but accosted Hamilton, who told him to renew his claim in writing. The stymied Francis now drifted into the twilight world of restless Hamilton haters. Pretty soon, he was meeting in New York with Jacob Clingman, the new husband of Maria Reynolds. He told Clingman, in boastful words reminiscent of those employed by James Reynolds 6 months earlier, that he could, if he pleased, hang Hamilton. Clingman was still trying to prove the preposterous notion that Hamilton had conspired with William Duer to rig the market in government securities, and Francis pretended that he had information linking Hamilton directly with Duer's ill-fated speculations. Reports of talks between Clingman and Francis were relayed to John Beckley, who passed along this falderal to Jefferson. Beckley was prepared to believe any hearsay that defamed Hamilton, even the ludicrous notion that Hamilton had offered Francis $2,000 for papers showing his supposed financial ties to Duer. Francis went so far as to claim that he knew the couriers who had carried payments between the two men. Beckley was also intrigued by Clingman's assertion that Maria Reynolds was now prepared to tell everything she knew about her husband's relations with Hamilton, as if the loose-tongued Maria had ever muzzled herself before. Although Jacob Clingman knew that Andrew Francis was an unsavory character, this did not dent his belief in the man's story. Beckley recorded of Clingman's reaction, "He considers Francis as a man of no principle, yet he is sure that he is privy to the whole connection with Duer. He tells me, too, that Francis is fond of drink and very avaricious, and that a judicious appeal to either of those passions would induce him to deliver up Hamilton's and Duer's letters and tell all he knows." Beckley was so famished for scandal about Hamilton that he traveled to New York and met with Francis to unravel this scene of iniquity. When Beckley tried to elicit documentation from Francis that would substantiate his wild allegations against Hamilton, the effort, as always, proved futile. All of this raw gossip flowed straight to the Secretary of State, who faithfully recorded every scrap in his diary, even though he had just received extreme proof of Beckley's bias. In his honors for June 7, 1793, Jefferson noted Beckley's crackpot story that the British had offered Hamilton asylum if his plans for an American monarchy miscarried. About this fairy tale, allegedly gleaned from Britain's Consul General in New York, Jefferson commented in the margin, "Impossible as to Hamilton. He was far above that." Jefferson then made this further observation on his chief source of political intelligence. "Beckley is a man of perfect truth as to what he affirms of his own knowledge, but too credulous as to what he hears from others." Nonetheless, Jefferson added to his swelling dossier on Hamilton the farrago of stories that Beckley had taken down from Clingman and Francis. By early July, Hamilton knew that enemies were tracking his movements and trying to extract information from Andrew Francis. He also knew that this spying operation was supervised by Jefferson's protege, Beckley. In early July, Hamilton took a potentially hazardous step by inviting Jacob Clingman to his office. We know roughly what Hamilton said because the dialogue was transmitted to Beckley. Like an attorney subtly probing a witness, Hamilton tried to draw Clingman out, asking if he knew Andrew Francis, had boarded at his house, had dined at his table, or had visited his office. Clingman admitted to one dinner and one office visit with Francis. Hamilton then told Clingman to discount what Francis said, as he spoke much at random and drank. Showing the accuracy of his suspicions, Hamilton then asked Clingman point blank if he ever visited John Beckley. Klingman said he had run into Beckley at the home of Frederick Muhlenberg, his former boss. This information could have only validated Hamilton's worst fears. Perhaps aware that Hamilton had been blackmailed with some success before, Francis wrote to him in early August and threatened to expose everything to the people if he did not get paid for his two warrants. Within hours, Hamilton sent back a furious reply. He was not about to repeat the mistake he made with James Reynolds. "Do you imagine that any menaces of appeal to the people can induce me to depart from what I conceive to be my public duty? I set you and all your accomplices at defiance." The next day, Hamilton did something out of character. He wrote a toned-down letter to Francis, apologized for his rash initial response, and merely protested the notion that he had failed to pay for the warrants because of some sinister motives. The change of tone apparently came about because Washington had received another letter from Francis and had asked Hamilton to comment on the case. This must have reminded Hamilton that he was dealing with official business, not just private threats. Hamilton explained the affair to Washington's satisfaction. At the same time, he sent a pointed letter to Francis's lawyer, warning of legal consequences if any fabricated documents were used against him. Undeterred, in late August, Francis published a pamphlet of his correspondence with Hamilton and Washington. On October 11th, an irate Hamilton placed a notice in two New York newspapers, informing the public that he had repeatedly asked Francis for proof of his charges and that Francis had evaded the request. Hamilton called his former employee contemptible and a despicable calumniator. The next day, an unrepentant Francis retorted in a rival paper that if I am a despicable calumniator, I have been, unfortunately, for a long time past, a pupil of Mr. Hamilton's. Francis kept up his diatribes, and Robert Troop and Rufus King gathered affidavits from prominent people attesting to Hamilton's innocence. It was testimony to the vile partisanship of the period that a disgruntled former government clerk, tainted by a well-known history of drinking, could sustain such a public assault upon Hamilton's character. It also testified to Hamilton's exaggerated need to free his name from the slightest stain that he felt obliged to trade public insults with such an obscure figure. The Francis controversy ended when the former clerk appealed for justice to Congress, citing Hamilton's supposed mishandling of his warrants. The charges, as Hamilton knew, lacked merit. On February 19, 1794, Congress passed two resolutions rejecting Francis's claims and commending Hamilton's honorable handling of the matter. Chapter 23. Citizen Genet. On March 4th, 1793, George Washington was sworn in for his second term as president. Unlike his talkative Treasury Secretary, the president believed in brevity and delivered a pithy inaugural address of two paragraphs. As he spoke in the Senate chamber, tension crackled below the surface of American politics that contrasted with the rapturous mood of the first inauguration. Fisher Ames, always a shrewd observer of the scene, mused that a spirit of faction must soon come to a crisis. He foresaw that congressional Republicans would discard their comparatively decorous criticism of Washington's first term. They thirst for vengeance. The Secretary of the Treasury is one whom they would immolate. The president is not to be spared. His popularity is a fund of strength to that cause which they would destroy. He is therefore rudely and incessantly attacked. Washington's second term revolved around inflammatory foreign policy issues. The French Revolution forced Americans to ponder the meaning of their own revolution, and followers of Hamilton and Jefferson drew diametrically opposite conclusions. The continuing turmoil in Paris added to the caution of Hamiltonians, who were trying to tamp down radical fires at home. Those same upheavals encouraged Jeffersonians to stoke the fires anew. Americans increasingly defined their domestic politics either by their solidarity with the French Revolution or their aversion to its incendiary methods. The French Revolution thus served both to consolidate the two parties in American politics and deepen the ideological gulf between them. Most Americans had applauded the French Revolution as a worthy successor to their own, a fraternal link renewed in August 1792 when the National Assembly in Paris bestowed honorary citizenship upon George Washington, N. Madison, and John Hamilton. When Hamilton received a letter from the French Interior Minister confirming this, he scribbled scornfully on the back, "Letter from Government of French Republic, transmitting me a diploma of citizenship, mistaking the Christian name." Curious example of French finesse. But events in Paris had taken a bloody turn that horrified American representatives there. During the summer of 1792, William Short, Jefferson's former private secretary in Paris, now stationed in The Hague, wrote to Jefferson of those mad and corrupted people in France who, under the name of liberty, have destroyed their own government. The Parisian streets, he warned, literally are red with blood. Short described to Hamilton mobs breaking into the royal palace and jailing King Louis XVI. In late August, a guillotine was erected near the Tuileries as Robespierre and Marat launched a wholesale roundup of priests, royalists, editors, judges, tramps, prostitutes, anyone deemed an enemy of the state. When 1,400 political prisoners were slaughtered in the so-called September massacres, an intoxicated Robespierre pronounced it the most beautiful revolution that has ever honored humanity. "Let the blood of traitors flow," agreed Marat. "That is the only way to save the country." For a long time, Jeffersonians had dismissed these reports of atrocities as rank propaganda. Moved by the soul-stirring rhetoric of the French Revolution, they affected the title of Jacobin and saluted one another as citizen or citizeness in solidarity with their French comrades. After France declared itself a republic on September 20th, 1792, American sympathizers feted the news with toasts, cannonades, and jubilation. When Jefferson replied to William Short's letter, he noted that the French Revolution had heartened American Republicans and undercut Hamiltonian monocrats. He regretted the lives lost in Paris, he said, then offered this chilling apologia. The liberty of the whole earth was depending on the issue of the contest. Rather than it should have failed, I would have seen half the earth desolated. For Jefferson, it was not just French or American freedom at stake, but that of the entire Western world. To his mind, such a universal goal excused the bloodthirsty means. On January 21st, 1793, more grisly events forced a reappraisal of the notion that the French Revolution was a romantic Gaelic variant of the American Revolution. Louis XVI, who had aided the American Revolution and whose birthday had long been celebrated by American patriots, was guillotined for plotting against the revolution. The death of Louis Capet, he had lost his royal title, was drenched in gore. Schoolboys cheered, threw their hats aloft, and licked the king's blood, while one executioner did a thriving business selling snippets of royal hair and clothing. The king's decapitated head was wedged between his lifeless legs, then stowed in a basket. The remains were buried in an unvarnished box. England reeled from the news, William Pitt the Younger branding it the foulest and most atrocious act the world has ever seen. On February 1st, France declared war against England, Holland, and Spain, and soon the whole continent was engulfed in fighting, ushering in more than 20 years of combat. News of the royal beheading reached America in late March 1793, at an inopportune time for the Jeffersonians, who had stressed France's moral superiority over Britain. Would they condemn or rationalize the action? The answer became clear when Freneau's National Gazette published an article entitled "Louis Capet Has Lost His Caput." The author qualified his levity in celebrating the king's death. "From my use of a pun, it may seem that I think lightly of his fate. I certainly do. It affects me no more than the execution of another malefactor." The author said that the king's murder represented a great act of justice, and anyone shocked by such wanton violence betrayed a strong remaining attachment to royalty and belonged to a monarchical junto. In other words, they were Hamiltonians. Once upon a time, Thomas Jefferson had lauded Louis XVI as a good man, an honest man. Now he asserted that monarchs should be amenable to punishment like other criminals. Madison admitted to some qualms about the follies and barbarities in Paris, but was generally no less militant than Jefferson in admiring the French Revolution, describing it as wonderful in its progress, and stupendous in its consequences. He denigrated its enemies as enemies of human nature. Madison agreed with Jefferson that if their French comrades failed, it would doom American republicanism. Madison was not fazed by Louis XVI's murder. If the king was a traitor, he said, he ought to be punished as well as another man. Like Jefferson, Madison filtered out upsetting facts about France and mocked as spurious newspaper accounts that talked about the king's innocence and the bloodthirstiness of his enemies. One mordant irony of this obstinate blindness was that while Republicans rejoiced in the French Revolution and cited the sacred debt owed to French officers who had fought in the American Revolution, those same officers were being victimized by revolutionary violence. Governor Morris, now U.S. Minister to France, informed Hamilton after the king's execution, "It has so happened that a very great proportion of the French officers who served in America have been either opposed to the revolution at an early day or felt themselves obliged at a later period to abandon it. Some of them are now in a state of banishment and their property confiscated." With the monarchy's fall, the Marquis de Lafayette was denounced as a traitor. He fled to Belgium, only to be captured by the Austrians and shunted among various prisons for 5 years. Tossed into solitary confinement, he eventually emerged wan and emaciated, a mostly hairless cadaver. Lafayette's family suffered grievously during the terror. His wife's sister, mother, and grandmother were all executed and dumped in a common grave. Other heroes of the American Revolution succumbed to revolutionary madness. The Comte de Rochambeau was locked up in the Conciergerie, while Admiral d'Estaing was executed. If Republicans turned a blind eye to these events, the pro-British bias of the Federalists perhaps sharpened their vision. As early as March 1792, Jefferson groused in his Annas about Washington's want of confidence in the event of the French Revolution. "I remember when I received the news of the king's flight and capture, I first told him of it at his assembly. I never saw him so much dejected by any event in my life." Washington was indeed sickened by the bloodshed in France, and this widened the breach between him and Jefferson. John Adams was quite prescient about events in France and regretted that many Americans were so blind, undistinguishing, and enthusiastic of everything that has been done by that light, airy, and transported people. He warned that Danton, Robespierre, Marat, etc. are furies. Dragon's teeth have been sown in France and will come up as monsters. No American was to expend more prophetic verbiage in denouncing the French Revolution than Alexander Hamilton. The suspension of the monarchy and the September massacres, Hamilton later told Lafayette, had cured me of my goodwill for the French Revolution. Hamilton refused to condone the carnage in Paris or separate means from ends. He did not think a revolution should cast off the past overnight or repudiate law, order, and tradition. "A struggle for liberty is in itself respectable and glorious," he opined. "When conducted with magnanimity, justice, and humanity, it ought to command the admiration of every friend to human nature. But if sullied by crimes and extravagancies, it loses its respectability." The American Revolution had succeeded because it was a free, regular, and deliberate act of the nation, and had been conducted with a spirit of justice and humanity. It was, in fact, a revolution written in parchment and defined by documents, petitions, and other forms of law. What threw Hamilton into despair was not just the betrayal of revolutionary hopes in France, but the way its American apologists ended up justifying a state of things the most cruel, sanguinary, and violent that ever stained the annals of mankind. For Hamilton, the utopian revolutionaries in France had emphasized liberty to the exclusion of order, morality, religion, and property rights. They had singled out for persecution bankers and businessmen, people Hamilton regarded as agents of progressive change. He saw the chaos in France as a frightening portent of what could happen in America if the safeguards of order were stripped away by the love of liberty. His greatest nightmare was being enacted across the Atlantic. A hopeful revolution giving way to indiscriminate terror and authoritarian rule. His conclusion was categorical. "If there be anything solid in virtue, the time must come when it will have been a disgrace to have advocated the revolution of France in its late stages." Reports that France had declared war against England and other royal powers did not reach American shores until early April, when Hamilton informed Washington, then at Mount Vernon, "There seems to be no room for doubt of the existence of war." Washington rushed back to Philadelphia to formulate policy. He inclined instantly toward neutrality and blanched at rumors that American ships were getting ready to wage war as pro-French privateers. Before Washington's arrival, Hamilton mulled over a neutrality proclamation and consulted with John Jay, not Thomas Jefferson, who was slowly being shunted aside in foreign policy. The day after his return on April 17th, Washington asked his advisers to ponder 13 questions for a meeting at his residence the next morning. The first question was the overriding one. Should the United States issue a proclamation of neutrality? The next 12 questions related to France. Among them, should America receive an ambassador from France? Should earlier treaties apply? Was France waging an offensive or defensive war? In these queries, with their implicit skepticism of France, Jefferson saw the handiwork of Hamilton, even though Washington had taken pains to write out the questions himself. With his usual fierce certitude, Hamilton believed that neutrality was the only proper course and had already lectured Washington on the need for a continuance of the peace, the desire of which may be said to be both universal and ardent. This had less to do with scruples about war than with a conviction shared by Washington that the young country needed a period of prosperity and stability before it was capable of combat. The United States did not even possess a regular navy. At such a moment, Hamilton said, war would be the most unequal and calamitous in which it is possible for a country to be engaged, a war which would not be unlikely to prove pregnant with greater dangers and disasters than that by which we established our existence as an independent nation. Though Jefferson sympathized with France and Hamilton with Great Britain, they agreed that neutrality was the only sensible policy. The two secretaries differed on the form this should assume, however, and 3 days of spirited debate ensued. At a dramatic session on April 19th, Washington listened as Jefferson, eager to extract concessions from England, opposed an immediate declaration of neutrality, or perhaps any declaration at all. Why not stall and make countries bid for American neutrality? Aghast, Hamilton said that American neutrality was not negotiable. Drawing on his formidable powers of persuasion, he pummeled his listeners with authorities on international law. Grotius, Vattel, and Pufendorf. Hamilton carried the day, and the cabinet decided to issue a declaration forbidding our citizens to take part in any hostilities on the seas with or against any of the belligerent powers. Jefferson was horrified at suspending the 1778 treaties with France sealed during the Revolution. But Hamilton argued that France had aided the American Revolution not from humanitarian motives, but only to weaken England. He also argued that the French, having toppled Louis XVI, had traded one government for another, rendering their former treaties null and void. Predictably, he opposed a friendly reception for the French minister recently arrived in America, lest it commit the United States to the French cause. Nonetheless, Jefferson triumphed on the issue of accepting the new French minister without qualifications, as Washington demonstrated anew that he was not a puppet in Hamilton's hands. On April 22nd, after days of heated rhetoric from Hamilton and Jefferson, Washington promulgated his proclamation of neutrality. Hamilton was the undisputed victor on the main point of issuing a formal, speedy executive declaration, but Jefferson won some key emphases. In particular, Jefferson had worried that the word neutrality would signal a flat rejection of France, so the document spoke instead of the need for U.S. citizens to be friendly and impartial toward the warring powers. The proclamation set a vital precedent for a proudly independent America, giving it an ideological shield against European entanglements. Of this declaration, Henry Cabot Lodge later wrote, "There is no stronger example of the influence of the Federalists under the leadership of Washington upon the history of the country than this famous proclamation, and in no respect did the personality of Hamilton impress itself more directly on the future of the United States." With the neutrality proclamation, Hamilton continued to define his views on American foreign policy, that it should be based on self-interest, not emotional attachment, that the supposed altruism of nations often masked baser motives, that individuals sometimes acted benevolently, but nations seldom did. This austere, hard-headed view of human affairs likely dated to Hamilton's earliest observations of the European powers in the West Indies. The Neutrality Proclamation provoked another contretemps between Jefferson and Hamilton. The Secretary of State opposed the form of this milestone in American foreign policy and expressed his indignation to Monroe. "Hamilton is panic-struck if we refuse our breach to every kick which Great Britain may choose to give it." Madison, too, was enraged by the anglified complexion of administration policy and dismissed the proclamation as a most unfortunate error. The executive branch, he thought, was usurping national security powers that properly belonged to the legislature. Didn't Congress alone have the power to declare war and neutrality? He deplored Hamilton's effort to shuffle off the treaty with France as a trick equally contemptible for the meanness and folly of it. Madison favored American support for France and bemoaned that Washington had succumbed to the unpopular cause of Anglomania. He still viewed the French Revolution as an inspirational fight for freedom and asked indignantly why George Washington should have anything to apprehend from the success of liberty in another country. On April 8, 1793, the new French minister to the United States sailed into Charleston, South Carolina, aboard the frigate Embuscade, and enjoyed a tumultuous reception from a giant throng. His name was Edmond Charles Genet, but he would be known to history, in the fraternal style popularized by the French Revolution, as Citizen Genet. Short and ruddy, the 30-year-old diplomat had flaming red hair, a sloping forehead, and an aquiline nose. Governor Morris sniffed that he had the manner and look of an upstart. Though he often acted like a political amateur, he had an excellent resume. Fluent in Greek at age 6, the translator of Swedish histories by 12, he spoke 7 languages, was an accomplished musician, and had already seen diplomatic service in London and St. Petersburg. He was so closely associated with the moderate Girondins that before the king's head was severed, there had been speculation that Citizen Genet might accompany the royal family to America. In social situations, the bustling young emissary could be charming and engaging, but he did not behave with the subtlety and prudence expected of a diplomat. Indeed, if Hamilton had decided to invent a minister to dramatize his fears of the French Revolution, he could have conjured up no better than the vain, extravagant, and bombastic Genet. The Frenchman was to swagger and bluster and wade blindly into the warfare between Hamilton and Jefferson. Citizen Genet landed with a lengthy agenda. He wanted the United States to extend more funds to France and supply foodstuffs and other army provisions. Much more controversially, he wanted to strike blows against Spanish and British possessions in North America and was ready to hire secret agents for that purpose. Jefferson became his clandestine accomplice when he furnished Genet with a letter introducing a French botanist named André Michaud to the governor of Kentucky. Michaud planned to arm Kentuckians and stir up frontier settlements in Spanish Louisiana. Jefferson's aide violated the policy of neutrality and made Hamilton's unauthorized talks with George Beckwith seem like tame indiscretions in comparison. What most roused Washington and Hamilton's ire was that Genet's satchel bulged with some blank letters of marque. These documents were to be distributed to private vessels, converting them into privateers. The marauding vessels could then capture unarmed British merchant ships as prizes, providing money for the captors and military benefits for France. Genet wanted to recruit American and French seamen. Once settled in South Carolina, he chartered privateers to prey on British shipping from American ports and also assembled a 1,600-man army to invade St. Augustine, Florida. In Philadelphia, Hamilton condemned this mischief as the height of arrogance and divined its true intent. Genet came to this country with the affectation of not desiring to embark us in the war, and yet he did all in his power by indirect means to drag us into it. Hamilton was convinced that, far from acting alone, Genet was executing official policy. His suspicions were to be vindicated. 10 days after his arrival, Citizen Genet began a prolonged journey north to Philadelphia to present his credentials to Washington. Acting more like a political candidate than a foreign diplomat, he was cheered at banquets, and his 6-week tour acquired major political overtones. In many cities, Genet's presence spawned Republican or Democratic societies whose members greeted and embraced each other as citizens. These groups feared that once the European powers had overthrown the French Revolution, they would crush its American counterpart. Jittery Federalists worried that the new societies would mimic the radical Jacobin clubs that had provoked mayhem in Paris. As these groups forged links with one another, Hamilton thought they might replicate the methods of the Sons of Liberty chapters that helped spark the American Revolution. As a precaution, he advised his customs collectors to inform him of any merchant ships in their ports being pierced with loopholes for guns, a sign they were being converted into privateers. With each day of his northward journey, the uproar over Genet's activities mounted, and Federalist resentment vied with Republican adulation. While Genet traveled, the Ambuscade pounced upon the British ship Grange in American waters and hauled this prize to Philadelphia. George Hammond, the British minister, protested hotly to Thomas Jefferson, noting that such actions mocked Washington's neutrality proclamation. The Secretary of State privately applauded these violations of U.S. law. When the Grange arrived in Philadelphia, Jefferson could not contain his joy. Upon her coming into sight, thousands and thousands crowded and covered the wharves, he told James Monroe. Never before was such a crowd seen there, and when the British colors were seen reversed and the French flag flying above them, they burst into peals of exultation. Enchanted by Genet, Jefferson informed Madison that he had offered everything and asks nothing. It is impossible for anything to be more affectionate, more magnanimous than the purport of his mission. This was all preamble to Citizen Genet's triumphant landing at Philadelphia on May 16th, 1793, when he was welcomed by Governor Thomas Mifflin amid repeated volleys of artillery fire. Republicans hoped that an outpouring of affection for Genet would cement Franco-American relations, and the two countries' flags flew side by side across the city. French sympathizers rented Philadelphia's biggest banquet hall for an elegant civic repast, passed around liberty caps, and roared out the Marseillaise. The new ambassador even joined a Jacobin club in Philadelphia. Jefferson was jubilant. The war has kindled and brought forward the two parties with an ardor which our own interests merely could never excite, he told Madison. One Federalist writer could not believe the adoration heaped on Genet. It is beyond the power of figures or words to express the hugs and kisses they lavished on him. Very few parts, if any, of the citizen's body escaped a salute. Where others saw camaraderie and high spirits, Hamilton detected an embryonic plot to subvert American foreign policy. The organizers of Genet's reception were the same men who have been uniformly the enemies and the disturbers of the government of the United States. Philadelphia was a stronghold of Republican sentiment, and leading figures flaunted their pro-French sentiments. John Adams was appalled by daily toasts drunk to Marat and Robespierre, and he recalled one given by Governor Mifflin. The ruling powers in France. May the United States of America, in alliance with them, declare war against England. At times, Francophile passion was so unbridled that Adams feared violence against Federalists. You certainly never felt the terrorism excited by Genet in 1793, Adams chided Jefferson years later, when 10,000 people in the streets of Philadelphia, day after day, threatened to drag Washington out of his house and effect a revolution in the government or compel it to declare war in favor of the French Revolution and against England. Though vice president, Adams felt so vulnerable to attack that he had a cache of arms smuggled through back lanes from the War Office to his home so that he could defend his family, friends, and servants. The new republic remained an unsettled place, rife with fears of foreign plots, civil war, chaos, and disunion. In private talks with George Hammond, Hamilton promised that he would vigorously contest efforts to lure America into war alongside France. He also predicted that the United States would extend no large advances to the revolutionary government, and he delayed debt payments owed to France. In a dispatch to London, Hammond noted that Hamilton would defend American neutrality because any event which might endanger the external tranquility of the United States would be as fatal to the systems he has formed for the benefit of his country as to his personal reputation and his ambition. If Hamilton's unofficial meetings with Hammond showed gross disloyalty to Jefferson, The latter repaid the favor. Soon after arriving in Philadelphia, Genet told his superiors in Paris of his candid talks with the Secretary of State. Jefferson gave me useful notions of men in office and did not at all conceal from me that Senator Robert Morris and Secretary of the Treasury Hamilton, attached to the interests of England, had the greatest influence over the President's mind, and that it was only with difficulty that he counterbalanced their efforts. Dubious about both the outcome and legitimacy of the French Revolution, Hamilton recommended that Genet be accorded a lesser diplomatic status. Washington overruled him and instructed Jefferson to receive the ambassador civilly, but with no real warmth, a reservation Jefferson interpreted as a small sacrifice by Washington to Hamilton's opinion. When Genet first arrived, Jefferson had resisted efforts to expel privateers in Charleston that Genet had equipped with weapons. Everybody else in the cabinet, Washington, Hamilton, Knox, Randolph, regarded these actions as an affront to American sovereignty and sought to banish the ships. On June 5th, Jefferson had to tell Genet to stop outfitting privateers and dragooning American citizens to serve on them. At this point, Genet again showed his inimitable cheek. Only 10 days after Jefferson's warning, he began to transform a captured British merchant ship, the Little Sarah, into an armed privateer renamed La Petite Démocrate. What made this additionally infuriating was that Genet defied American orders in Philadelphia, under the immediate eye of the government, as Hamilton put it. Hamilton and Knox wanted the ship returned to Britain or ordered from American shores. Washington adopted this latter course over Jefferson's dissent. Amid this imbroglio, Hamilton wrote to Washington on June 21st that he wished to resign when the next congressional session ended in June 1794. He wanted enough time to enact the programs he had initiated and to clear his name in the ongoing inquiry led by William Branch Giles, but he was chafing under the restraints of office. He kept scribbling tirades against the French Revolution and then stashing them in the drawer. The day after Hamilton drafted his letter to Washington, Citizen Genet informed Jefferson that France had the right to outfit ships in American ports, and what was more, the American people agreed with him. Hamilton, taken aback by this effrontery, termed the letter the most offensive paper perhaps that ever was offered by a foreign minister to a friendly power with which he resided. A few days later, Hamilton had a tense exchange with Genet, telling him that France was the aggressor in the European war and that this freed America from any need to comply with their old defense treaty. When Hamilton defended Washington's right to declare neutrality, Genet retorted that this misuse of executive power usurped congressional prerogatives. The scene had decided elements of farce. Citizen Genet was lecturing the chief author of the Federalist Papers on the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. On July 6th, Citizen Genet committed a colossal blunder that dwarfed all previous gaffes. With Washington at Mount Vernon, Genet took advantage of his absence to inform Alexander J. Dallas, the Secretary of Pennsylvania, that he rejected the notion of American neutrality. He said that he planned to go above Washington's head and appeal directly to the American people, asking their assistance to rig French privateers in American ports. Genet was doing more than just flouting previous warnings. He was clumsily insulting the U.S. government and slapping the face of the one man who could not be slapped, George Washington. Dallas related the story to Governor Mifflin, who passed it on to Hamilton and Knox, who passed it on to Washington. Suddenly, Jefferson's enchantment with Genet disappeared. "Never, in my opinion, was so calamitous an appointment made as that of the present minister of France here," he protested to Madison. "Hot-headed, all imagination, no judgment, passionate, disrespectful, and even indecent toward the president in his written as well as verbal communications. He renders my position immensely difficult." Hamilton was outraged, while also mindful that Genet had handed him a blunt weapon to wield against France. On July 8th, Hamilton, Jefferson, and Knox conferred at the State House to figure out what to do with La Petite Démocrate. The absent Washington had already ruled that privateers armed in American ports should be stopped or forcibly seized. Hamilton and Knox wanted to post a militia and guns at a strategic spot called Mud Island, a few miles down the Delaware River, preventing the ship from escaping. Jefferson favored the milder course of dealing with American crew members rather than the ship itself. While not making promises, Genet told Jefferson that the vessel wouldn't sail from Philadelphia before Washington returned. Hamilton, who did not trust Genet, wanted forcible action to prevent La Petite Démocrate from getting away. In a memo, he wrote, "It is a truth the best founded and of the last importance that nothing is so dangerous to a government as to be wanting either in self-confidence or self-respect." But Hamilton could not prevail upon his colleagues to use force. Washington returned to Philadelphia on July 11th. La Petite Démocrate managed to slip away and sail past Mud Island on July 12th. On the spot, Hamilton proposed that the French government be asked to recall Genet. Even Jefferson registered no protest. A few days later, La Petite Démocrate was at sea. As he watched Genet's boorish behavior, Hamilton longed to broadcast his views to the public. He was not born to be a silent spectator of events. By late June, Hamilton could contain himself no longer and rushed into print. On June 29, 1793, a writer billing himself as Pacificus inaugurated the first of seven essays in the Gazette of the United States that defended the Neutrality Proclamation. Throughout July, Hamilton's articles ran twice weekly, their impact enhanced by Citizen Genet's intolerable antics. In the first essay, Hamilton dealt with the objection that only Congress could issue a neutrality proclamation since it alone had the power to declare war. Hamilton pointed out that if the legislature have a right to make war on the one hand, it is on the other the duty of the executive to preserve peace till war is declared. Once again, Hamilton broadened the authority of the executive branch in diplomacy, especially during emergencies. He also speculated that the real reason behind the brouhaha over neutrality was the opposition's desire to weaken or remove Washington from office. In the second essay, he disputed that the Neutrality Proclamation violated the defensive alliance with France. That treaty, Hamilton noted, did not apply to offensive wars, and France had declared war against other European powers. In the third essay, Hamilton evoked the devastation that might result if America was dragged into war on France's side. Great Britain and Spain could instigate numerous Indian tribes under their influence to attack the United States from the interior. Meanwhile, with a long, extended seacoast, with no fortifications whatever, and with a population not exceeding 4 million, the United States would find itself in an unequal contest. In subsequent installments, Pacificus presented Louis XVI as a benevolent man and a true friend of America. "I am much misinformed if repeated declarations of the venerable Franklin did not attest this fact." French support for the American Revolution, he argued, had emanated from the king and high government circles, not the masses. If there was any kindness in the decision to support America, demanding a return of kindness from us, it was the kindness of Louis XVI. His heart was the depository of the sentiment. It took courage for Hamilton, stigmatized as a crypto-monarchist, to express sympathy for a dead king. In the last Pacificus essay, he defended American neutrality on the grounds that a country without armies, without fleets, was too immature to prosecute war. To amplify his views, Hamilton organized rallies to demonstrate popular approval of the Neutrality Proclamation. Hamilton was always fond of his Pacificus essays, which show the impassioned pragmatism that informed his foreign policy views. He later incorporated them into an 1802 edition of The Federalist, proudly telling the publisher that some of his friends had pronounced them to be his best performance. Hamilton must have enjoyed bundling these essays with The Federalist, because they had provoked a venomous response from his main Federalist co-author, James Madison. It was Jefferson who prodded Madison into taking on Hamilton over the Neutrality Proclamation. Jefferson had read the first few Pacificus essays with mounting dismay and decided once again to deploy a proxy to refute Hamilton. On July 7th, he urged Madison to tilt lances with the Treasury Secretary. "Nobody answers him, and his doctrines will therefore be taken for confessed. For God's sake, my dear sir, take up your pen, select the most striking heresies, and cut him to pieces in the face of the public. There is nobody else who can and will enter the lists with him." Jefferson must have thought that Madison would leap at the chance to resist the expanded executive powers embodied in the Neutrality Proclamation. Instead, Madison balked. From his Virginia plantation, he complained to Jefferson that he lacked the necessary books and papers to refute Pacificus, and he griped about the summer heat. He blamed hordes of house guests who overstayed their welcomes. Did even Madison tremble at the thought of confronting Hamilton? When he had exhausted all excuses, he told Jefferson grudgingly, "I have forced myself into the task of a reply. I can try."